Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, dear friends, hope you've had a good lunch. It gives me great pleasure to introduce this afternoon's speaker, Professor Eamon Duffy, Professor Emeritus of the History of Christianity at Cambridge and a Fellow of Magdalen College, where he was president. There are very few intellectuals in the lives of both our churches today who have made such an important and wide-ranging contribution as Professor Duffy. From his best-known 1992 groundbreaking work, The Stripping of the Altars, to extraordinarily perceptive contributions in journals, popular and otherwise, as well as in other published work on diverse topics, he is truly a theologian's historian and a historian's theologian. But much more importantly than any of that, he loves the church and excites others with that very rich vision. Professor Duffy's title this afternoon is Walsingham, From Ruin to Restoration. And I know that we're in for a tour de force. Eamon, it's a thrill to have you with us.
Can I begin by saying that I think it's characteristic of the generosity and largeness of heart and mind of the Church of England to invite an Irish Roman Catholic to address this particular audience. But let's begin with an ending, with the haunting Tudor lament for the destruction of the Shrine of Our Lady at Walsingham. In the racks of Walsingham, whom should I choose but the Queen of Walsingham to be guide to my muse? Then, thou Prince of Walsingham, grant me to frame bitter plaints to rue thy wrong, bitter woe for thy name. Bitter was it, oh, to see the silly sheep murdered by the ravening wolves while the shepherds did sleep. Bitter was it, oh, to view the sacred vine, while the gardeners played all too close, rooted up by the swine. Bitter, bitter, oh, to behold the grass to grow, where the walls of Walsingham so stately did show. Such were the worth of Walsingham while she did stand. Such are the racks as now do show of that so holy land. Level with the ground the towers do lie, which with their golden glittering tops pierced once to the sky. Where were gates are no gates now, the ways unknown, where the press of peers did pass while her fame far was blown. Owls do shriek where the sweetest hymns lately were sung. Toads and serpents hold their dens where the palmers did throng. Weep, weep, O Walsingham, whose days are nights. Blessings turn to blasphemies, holy deeds to despites. Sin is where Our Lady sat, heaven turned is to hell. Satan sits where Our Lord did sway. Walsingham, oh, farewell. That poem's often attributed to St. Philip Howard, in which case it was written by a man who never saw Walsingham in its glory, but it's been plausibly suggested, since it seems to express a more urgent and despairing sentiment, that it may in fact be the work of an eyewitness and was written perhaps in the 1540s. But however that is, the shrine it laments and which Henry VIII's commissioners destroyed in July 1538 had been established early in the 12th century by a wealthy woman, Riqueldis de Favrache, the widow of a local Norman landowner, Geoffrey de Favrache. She's mentioned, though not named, in the pipe rolls for 1131 when she was just about to remarry. And at that stage she had an infant son, who must be Geoffrey II, who founded Walsingham Priory in 1153 to administer his mother's chapel, which by then had evidently become a shrine of at least local celebrity. That much can be documented from a handful of surviving contemporary records. Everything else that is normally said about the foundation of the shrine, and especially its foundation date of 1061, is derived from a single, and I'm sorry to say, utterly unreliable 15th century source, a very bad 140-line poem in rhyme royal, originally displayed for the benefits of pilgrims on a notice board in the Holy House and printed for the shrine authorities in 1496 by the London publisher Richard Pinson. He published 4 or 5 of these shrine legends. They are all equally unreliable, and they all establish an improbably early date for the foundation of their shrine. That ballad survives in a single copy, as it happens, in the Pepys Library in my own Cambridge College, Magdalen. It's the source for the elaborate story of Rekeldus's vision of Our Lady, for the account of the miraculous relocation by angels of the house from the site on which her workmen had first tried to erect it, and crucially, for the foundation date of 1061. But no medieval document before 1496 offers any date for the foundation of the shrine, nor of any vision of Our Lady of Walsingham, and we can only speculate what Rekeldus had in mind when she built her chapel. That said, there's no reason to doubt that she did indeed build a chapel to the supposed measurements of the Holy House at Nazareth. At least since the 6th century, pilgrims to the Holy Land had measured the holy places using pieces of knotted string so that they could bring the string back to England and build replicas to the same dimensions for the benefit of those unable to make the long and dangerous journey to the Holy Land across land and sea. These replicas were believed to convey the same spiritual blessings as their originals, and the Stations of the Cross, for example, grew out of the same urge to provide spiritual benefits of following the Via Dolorosa for the folks back home. So what distinguished the shrine at Walsingham from every other Marian shrine in the country, and what helps to explain why it became the leading shrine in England of Our Lady, was that it contained a replica of the Holy House. But for the shrine's first century or so, we can deduce that pilgrim numbers were very small. The priory was one of the poorest priories in the country. And what changed that was the favour shown to Walsingham by the builder of this abbey, Henry III. He probably became interested in Walsingham primarily because it was en route to Bromham, which had a relic of the True Cross, and he was very interested in passion relics. He wanted this building to be a relic for the Holy Blood. He first visited it en route to Bromham in 1226, but he made at least a dozen other visits to Walsingham, and he began to bestow enormous largesse on it, very famously the gift of wax for 3,000 tapers to burn on the Feast of the Assumption at the Holy House in 1241. One's surprised that it didn't burn down. And where royalty led, of course, courtiers and the fashionable followed. That's the press of peers that's mentioned in the lament that I began with. Edward I, Henry's son, was even more devoted to Walsingham than his father. He believed he'd been preserved from being crushed by falling masonry by Our Lady of Walsingham, and he made annual visits here throughout his reign. And thereafter, till the break with Rome, the only English king who never went to Walsingham was, of course, Richard III. Signs of royal favour accumulated, not least in Henry VIII's reign. Catherine of Aragon, who was acting as regent for the kingdom while Henry was away, donated the battle standards from the field of Flodden to the Holy House. We can't prove it statistically, but by the early 15th century, Walsingham's celebrity was exceeded only by Becket Shrine at Canterbury, and perhaps not even by that. The priory, once the poor cousin of all the other Augustinian houses in England, had become one of the richest monasteries in the land, and the shrine itself was gloriously decorated with not just the usual wax ex votos and crutches and so on, but with the accumulated gifts of grateful pilgrims. As Erasmus reported after his visit in 1511, you would say it was the abode of saints, so dazzling it is with jewels, gold and silver. Philip North wouldn't approve of that sentiment. But of course, all that came to an abrupt end with the dissolution of the priory and the shrine in 1538. The statue was carted off to Cromwell's house at Chelsea and burnt alongside other famous images, Our Lady of Worcester, Our Lady of Ipswich, Our Lady of Willesden. The gold and silver ex votos were dispatched to the King's Jewel House to be melted down, and the priory was unroofed. And we can only guess at the psychic and emotional impact of the sudden destruction of England's greatest Marian shrine. Even before the actual dissolution, it triggered the so-called Walsingham Plot of 1537, which led to the execution of a number of Walsingham men, including the sub-prior of the monastery. But resistance didn't last. The idea of Walsingham as England's Nazareth, the Holy Land of Walsingham, lingered till the end of the century. It's reflected in a number of slightly disreputable late Elizabethan love songs and in Ophelia's song in the mad scene in Hamlet. And then the shrine simply disappears from English consciousness till the mid-19th century. The owners of the priory, the Lee Warners, conducted an amateurish excavation of the priory grounds in 1854, the one positive outcome of which was that they did identify the actual site of the Holy House. But the first comprehensive discussion of the shrine didn't appear till 1879, with the publication of the Roman Catholic antiquary Edmund Waterton's Pietas Mariana Britannica. This was an idealized evocation of medieval England, Mary's dowry. Waterton's romantic medievalism had more than a touch of ye olde English tea shoppy about it. He insisted, for example, on spelling Our Lady's name, Mary, with a terminal E, and her title, Our Lady, with a terminal E, Our Lady. But he devoted 54 pages to a detailed account of the medieval shrine, its similarities and differences from the more famous Italian shrine of Loreto, with copious documentation from the priory's cartulary, from the Pinson Ballad, from records of royal and aristocratic benefactions, from William of Worcester's important measurement of the shrine in 1479, and from Erasmus's satirical account of his 1511 pilgrimage. And he concluded with documentation of the dissolution and by printing that lament for Walsingham in full. Now, Pietas Mariana attracted a very wide readership, Anglican as well as Roman Catholic, and those readers included an outstanding Tractarian priest, Arthur Wagner, who was the vicar of St. Paul's Brighton for 50 years. Wagner really was an eminent Victorian who used his immense personal wealth to build houses for the poor of Brighton, to found a religious order for women to work in charity schools and with reformed prostitutes, and he built a series of spectacular chapels of ease, as big as cathedrals, in the town, which all became flagships for advanced Anglo-Catholic ritual and teaching. Wagner had a long-standing interest in Walsingham. He was a voracious reader with a library of over 12,000 books. But the publication of Pietas Mariana focused it. In 1886, he built a church dedicated to the Virgin Mary on his country estate in Sussex at Buxted. And its Lady Chapel was built to the measurements of the Holy House of Loretto. And an internal screen marked off the dimensions of the Holy House of Walsingham, as reported by William of Worcester in Pietas Mariana. There was no statue, and there was no attempt to revive pilgrimage, but within a decade of its construction, this Buxted Walsingham Chapel would exercise the decisive influence on the revival, first of Roman Catholic pilgrimage to Walsingham, and then in the longer term, the creation of the Anglican Holy House. And the link between Buxted and Walsingham was Father Philip Fletcher. In the early 1870s, Fletcher had been one of Wagner's curates at St. Bartholomew, Brighton. And though he soon after became a Roman Catholic, Fletcher remained grateful to Wagner for all he'd learned from him, and he was extremely interested in the creation of the Walsingham Chapel at Buxted. In 1887, Fletcher was one of the two co-founders of the Guild of Our Lady of Ransom, a Roman Catholic organization dedicated to the conversion of England. I'm sorry to say in this place, from Anglicanism. But it also offered financial aid to impoverished Catholic parishes. In 1896, the Roman Catholic priest at King's Lynn, Father George Wigglesworth, issued an urgent appeal for funds because his Pugin Church was falling down. On behalf of the Guild, Fletcher went to see how they could help. King's Lynn had been, of course, a stopping point on the northern route and the Baltic route to Walsingham. It had a famous 14th century chapel which was said to be associated with the shrine, Our Lady of the Mount. It's still one of the sites of King's Lynn, that lovely town. Fletcher suggested that the new church in Lynn should include a lady chapel, like the chapel at Buxted, built to the measures of the Holy House. As it happened, Father Wigglesworth had made the pilgrimage to Loretto, so he was keen on this idea, and he eagerly took up the suggestion. In 1897, he obtained a papal rescript from Pope Leo XIII, re-establishing the ancient shrine of Our Lady of Walsingham in King's Lynn. According to Fletcher, the Pope had declared that when England comes back to Walsingham, Mary will come back to England. On August the 19th that year, 1897, a new statue of Our Lady of Walsingham, it was a standing statue with the child modeled on a Roman prototype. They didn't know about the medieval seal at that stage. It was carved at Oberammergau, and it was processed through the streets of King's Lynn from the railway station via the chapel on the mount to the new church by a crowd of hundreds, led by 30 little girls dressed in white who sang an adaptation of the Lord hymn. We sang another slightly less reputable version today. The preacher at benediction that afternoon underlined the significance of the re-established shrine for a resurgent Roman Catholicism in England. All past Christian glories are ours. Renew them. Create others. The future of the church in this land depends on the seeds which are now being sown. Now, the King's Lynn Chapel was to remain the official Roman Catholic shrine to Our Lady of Walsingham for the next 40 years. But both Father Wigglesworth and Father Fletcher aspired to re-establish the pilgrimage in the village itself. And the means to do so seemed providentially to hand. In 1894, another wealthy Anglo-Catholic philanthropist, Miss Charlotte Boyd, crossed the Tiber and became a Roman Catholic. One of her many Anglican enterprises had been the purchase of former monastic sites in order to return them to charitable or religious uses. In 1893, as an Anglican, she had begun negotiations to buy a medieval wayside chapel in the village of Horton, just outside Walsingham. Tradition had it that this so-called slipper chapel, which till recently had functioned as a barn and a cow byre, was the place where pilgrims, including Henry VIII, had shed their shoes to walk the last stony mile to the Holy House. But negotiations were protracted, and by the time she got hold of the chapel, she had changed churches and was now eager to see the chapel become the base for a revived Roman Catholic pilgrimage. So the day after the enthronement of the new statue in the chapel at King's Lynn, Father Fletcher, Father Wrigglesworth, Miss Boyd, and a party of 50 members of the Guild of Ransom took train from King's Lynn to Walsingham and processed from the railway station with cross, candles, and banners to the Slipper Chapel, singing the Litany of Loretto and the Ave Maris Stella, the first public pilgrimage to Walsingham since the Reformation. But at this point, Fletcher's and Boyd's residual Anglican romanticism came into head-on conflict with pastoral reality and the constrained finances and manpower of the most struggling Roman Catholic diocese in England. There were no Roman Catholics in Walsingham, and very few in North Norfolk, which was part of the vast diocese of Northampton, seven counties, with only a scattering of Roman Catholics in them. The bishop was a fine person, Bishop Arthur Riddell. He wasn't blind to the imaginative appeal of the idea of Walsingham, but his priority had to be the provision of pastoral care for the larger centres of population in the region. He was willing to consider establishing a mission priest at the Slipper Chapel as a basis for outreach to larger nearby centres of population like Dereham, Fakenham, and Wells. And very quickly, a Catholic parish was established at Fakenham. But Miss Boyd mistakenly believed that the Slipper Chapel had been run by Benedictine monks in the Middle Ages, and she dreamt of re-establishing a monastic community there. The correspondence between her and the bishop became increasingly exasperated and resulted in the end in her offering the chapel to the diocese for the unrealistically large sum of £2,000. Bishop Riddell would have loved to have got his hands on £2,000. On the bishop's refusal, she donated the chapel to Downside Abbey in the West Country. Riddell, however, wasn't having this, and he issued a prohibition, which he got the Pope to back up, for any public cultus at the chapel, including the celebration of Mass. When the priest of the Suffolk Benedictine parish of Beccles, which was a dependency of Downside Abbey, broached the possibility of organizing parish pilgrimages to Walsingham, Riddell told him, "There is only one pilgrimage approved by me, that to the shrine of Our Lady of Walsingham at Lynn. I cannot approve any other." Now, in fact, Riddell did not rule out entirely the idea of reviving pilgrimage in Walsingham itself, but he considered that, quote, "the only reason to my mind for translating the shrine from Lynn would be the recovery of the exact spot of the ancient shrine and the reconstruction of the old Loretto. we must wait patiently for better times in North Norfolk. At one stage, it looked as if he wouldn't have to wait long, because the aspiration to get hold of the original site of the Holy House very nearly materialized. The heir presumptive to the Lee Warner estates, which included the site, became a Roman Catholic in 1907 and took a solemn vow to restore the Holy House as a Roman Catholic shrine when he came into possession. But Mammon intervened. In the event, the financial burdens on the estate, which became close to bankruptcy, meant that it passed instead into the hands of the Lee Warner's bankers, the Gurney family, who were originally Quakers. And the dream of a restored Roman Catholic Holy House evaporated. It's at this point that Father Alfred Hope Patton enters the story. I don't know if there's anybody present who knew him. Hope Patton was a charismatic but complex character who has always divided opinion, dogged by recurrent bouts of ill health, real and imaginary, and quite probably dyslexic. Hope Patton had a phobia about examinations. He never passed one. He left school at 16, and he never went to university, though he subsequently acquired a remarkable stock of specialist ecclesiastical learning. Like many autodidacts, his mind was narrowly focused, and he found it almost impossible to see other people's point of view. But he was handsome, charming, austerely holy, and when enthused, hugely energetic. And his charm, his energy, and his single-mindedness enabled the creation and preservation of the Anglican shrine we're celebrating today. Hope Patton was that rare and exotic creature, an Anglican papalist, raised in the advanced ritualism of Brighton's Anglo-Catholic churches. He came to believe that the Church of England was neither an autonomous body nor a distinct branch of the universal church, but an integral part of Latin Christendom, owing obedience to the Pope, though sadly separated by tragic circumstances from visible communion with the Holy See. He didn't like to speak of the Church of England. He preferred the phrase, the provinces of Canterbury and York. Anglican clergy were therefore obliged to obey the laws and liturgical norms of the Western Church, including celibacy of the clergy, examine your consciences, and any local canons, formularies, or episcopal diktats which conflicted with those wider norms could and should be ignored or circumvented. Some Anglo-Papalist clergy followed the logic of this and used the entire Roman liturgy in Latin. Hope Patton couldn't do that because he didn't know any Latin. And after 1912, most of them probably used the English Missal, which was a translation of the Roman Missal into Tudor-style prose with a few modifications to permit a nod in the direction of the Book of Common Prayer. Anglo-Papalists dismissed more genteel, self-consciously English forms of high churchmanship as British Museum religion. They favored fiddleback vestments, berettas, Baroque architecture. They were militant, self-consciously transgressive, opposition-minded. They were effectively Congregationalists in their ecclesiology, constitutionally suspicious of bishops, whom they were prone to view as troublesome, dubiously Christian agents of the secular state. Travels in France and Belgium, he was a great traveler. He took long, long holidays, gave Hope Patton a vision of what English parish churches might have looked like if there had been no Reformation, and models for how they ought to look like now. A series of curacies in advanced Anglo-Catholic parishes, including a year at Buxted, consolidated this. He discovered a lifelong fascination with relics and began to collect them. He developed a very strong Eucharistic piety, and at Buxted, he fell in love with the idea of Walsingham. Public devotion to the Blessed Virgin had never been a dominant feature of mainstream Tractarianism, but the Angelus, the Rosary, the Litany of Loreto featured strongly in Anglo-Papalist piety in general and in his in particular, alongside the service of benediction with the Blessed Sacrament, which most other high churchmen thought a bridge too far along the road to Rome, and which was a particular red rag to the majority of the Anglican episcopate in the 1920s and 30s. And in 1921, Hope Patton was offered the post of Vicar of Walsingham, an impoverished living with three churches, which after months of agonized indecision, he accepted, with the explicit determination to restore the pilgrimage, and with it, to restore devotion to the Blessed Virgin Mary to the church in England. Within a year of his arrival, he'd found in the British Museum a seal which depicted the medieval shrine image, and he commissioned a replica from a Roman Catholic shop. The replica was carved by a Roman Catholic Carmelite nun based on the seal. It was solemnly blessed and installed in a side chapel of the parish church in July 1922, and at once he introduced the custom of the daily recitation of the rosary before the statue. He was a great inventor of immemorial custom. As is our custom, he used to say when he'd had his latest wheeze. The first pilgrimage to the image was advertised through the Anglo-Papalist League of Our Lady for late October the same year, and it was a catastrophe. Only two of the expected 40 pilgrims for whom food and accommodation had been provided turned up. But with characteristic resourcefulness, Hope Patton marched into the village, rounded up everybody who was not bedridden or out at work, formed them into a procession, and the pilgrimage went ahead as a parish event. But soon a more successful pattern emerged. Several residential pilgrimages a year. One of the distinctions between the Anglican and the Roman Catholic shrines was that from the very start, the Anglican shrines specialized in residential rather than day pilgrimages. These were initially recruited from Anglo-Papalist networks in London and the South Coast, but eventually they attracted parties from Anglo-Catholic parishes in the Midlands and later the North. These jamborees were soon given additional weight by the presence of Mowbray Stephen O'Rourke, who was the retired former Bishop of Accra, who became rector of Blakeney, not far away, 6 or 7 miles away, in 1924, and who cheerfully presided at High Mass and solemn pontifical vespers and benediction as a regular part of the pilgrimage liturgy, wearing a mitre a good deal taller and more impressive than the Pope's. Houses in the village were acquired to serve as pilgrim hostels. A group of nuns were recruited from Yorkshire to assist with the pilgrims. An association of priests was formed to promote interest in Anglo-Catholic parishes. And a journal, Our Lady's Mirror, created to inform and promote the growing network of supporters. And gradually, the parish church itself was transformed into an ever more appropriate setting for pilgrimages. It filled up with statues, lamps, reliquaries, side altars. And remarkably, Hope Patton seems to have managed all this without alienating his conservative Norfolk parishioners. In his early years in Walsingham, at least, a steady stream of local boys was recruited as altar boys. Attendance at the Sunday High Mass was regularly in three figures in this small community. And stolid Protestant North Norfolkers queued for the confessional. All this eventually aroused the vigilance of the Bishop of Norwich, Bernard Pollock, a conservative low churchman who viewed this nest of Mariolatry in his diocese with a distaste and a disbelief amounting to horror. In 1930, he came to see what was going on for himself. He was aghast at the confessional in the North Aisle, the tabernacle and reliquaries in the Lady Chapel, and most of all by the candle stand in front of the statue of Our Lady of Walsingham under its canopy. "It is all much, much worse than I feared." Bishop Pollock asked Hope Patton to remove the statue and replace it with a picture or icon, a curious foible that has persisted in Anglicanism. I notice at the back of the church here. The vicar meekly agreed to remove it from the parish church altogether, but this was not the victory that the bishop imagined, because Hope Patton had already acquired a plot of land near the Priory grounds on Holt Road, and he now determined, if he hadn't already determined, to build a shrine chapel there. Quite apart from the symbolic significance of the restoration of the Holy House, a shrine on private property would be far less vulnerable to external interference, and so more likely to survive Hope Patton himself. And to ensure that, Hope Patton founded a college of lay and clerical guardians under a master who would govern the shrine and insulate it against episcopal meddling or a change of incumbent in the parish. The site of the Holy House had been established, quite rightly, by the excavation of 1854. But Hope Patton, with very little difficulty, convinced himself that this new shrine was in fact on the exact spot of Rakeldus's chapel, a conviction which was clinched when a sealed up Saxon well with some old shoes in it was discovered in the course of digging the foundations. Like Lourdes, Walsingham would have its own healing waters. And from this point on, he would insist on the absolute continuity of the old and the new shrines. The robed and crowned statue of Our Lady was solemnly processed to its new home by a crowd of hundreds, again led by white-clad maidens, on October the 15th, 1931. The preacher that day was one of Hope Patton's admired, almost adored mentors, Father Alban Bavistock, an uncompromising Anglo-papalist who would not use liturgy in English. And his sentiments on the occasion were apocalyptic. "On all sides, attacks are being made on traditional Christian doctrine and morals. And too often, the Anglican trumpeter gives an uncertain note or even seems to sound on behalf of the enemy. We learn to our sorrow that our bishops cannot be depended upon to defend Christian doctrine or even Christian morals. But we must not lose heart on this account. Put not your trust in princes, not even princes ecclesiastical. The enemy is coming in like a flood. But surely here in Walsingham, with the re-erection of England's Nazareth, with its shrine to the Incarnation, the Spirit of the Lord is lifting up a banner. Faith will rally in those whose heart are round this banner. And where there is faith in the Holy Incarnation, faith in the Word made flesh of Mary's flesh, there is victory assured, and this is the victory that overcometh the world, our faith." There's an air of defiant beleaguerment about the sermon, although the 1920s and 30s were in fact the heyday of Anglo-Catholicism. Most of those involved with the shrine in those days undoubtedly shared Bavistock's sense of belonging to an enlightened but beleaguered minority, a remnant. There are accounts of some of the early pilgrims in those days sallying out in small groups to recite the rosary in some of the more low church parishes in the Walsingham area, buoyed up by a sense that they were striking a blow for the full faith. And Hope Patton shared all that, but he also saw the shrine as a powerhouse for the rest of the Church of England, an instrument of the Anglo-Papalist project of reunion with the Holy See by transforming Anglican practice Romewards from the grassroots. And he was anything but apologetic about his papalism. The Latin inscription on the dedication stone of the shrine read, "This shrine, founded in the year 1061, at the will of the Blessed Virgin Mother of God in honor of the mystery of the Sacred Incarnation and afterwards utterly overthrown by the king who raged with the most foul love of gain on whose soul God have mercy, now for the first time in the year 1931 and the ninth year of the pontificate of our most holy Lord Pope Pius XI, Pontifex Maximus, was restored. Bertram, Bishop of the Church of Norwich, and Hope Patton, Parish Priest of Walsingham, holding office ad majorem Dei Gloriae." Despite Hope Patton's explanation that the inscription was intended, quote, as a witness to the claim of Anglicans, which claim our English Roman friends will not allow, namely that we believe that in this year of grace, 1931, the rightful parish priest of Walsingham is Hope Patton, not Father Grey of Fakenham, and that the true bishop of the diocese is Dr. Pollock and not the Bishop of Northampton, Bishop Pollock was neither persuaded nor amused, and he insisted that his name be removed from what became known as the Stone of Offence. The paradox was, of course, that devoted as he was to Roman ways, and from the 1930s onwards incorporating more and more of those ways into the shrine's worship, Hope Patton, in fact, never much liked Roman Catholics, our brethren of the Italian mission. And it must be said with some reason. In 1925, the proprietor of the Slipper Chapel, the Abbot of Downside, had refused permission for Anglicans to recite the Rosary in the Slipper Chapel. And when, in 1932, Hope Patton asked the monks of Prinish, who had a printing house, to print some prayer cards for his shrine, he'd been rebuffed by the abbot, who wrote insufferably, "You see, dear sir, we Catholics naturally feel that the pre-Reformation shrine should be in our hands, from which it was torn at the Reformation. While we rejoice sincerely at the revival of devotion to the Blessed Mother of God among Anglicans, we feel that the official cultus belongs to us." But by the mid-1930s, the Brethren of the Italian Mission had arrived on Hope Patton's doorstep. In 1931, Downside, discouraged by the continuing episcopal ban on public worship at the Slipper Chapel, donated it to the Diocese of Northampton. And then in 1933, Lawrence Ewens, a former Anglican, enthusiastic about the idea of a Roman Catholic presence at Walsingham, became Bishop of Northampton. And he immediately set about restoring the chapel. He turned to his assistant, the marvelous Father Squirrel of Norwich, at his consecration, the moment he became bishop, and he said, "What shall we do, Father?" And Father Squirrel said, "Restore Walsingham." A statue, modelled like the Anglican one on the Walsingham Priory seal, it was designed by Professor Tristram, it's not the present statue, was installed there under a painted canopy, and on August the 19th, 1934, Cardinal Bourne, who was dying at the time, he died a few months later, accompanied by eight of the bishops, Roman Catholic bishops of England and Wales, led a huge open-air pilgrimage of 12,000 people in the meadow beside the Slipper Chapel, and designated the chapel England's National Shrine to Our Lady. In the following year, Ewens appointed a newly ordained priest, Bruno Scott James, as custodian of the shrine. Now, Scott James was in fact a former Anglican monk. He'd belonged to the proto-Nashton community, and he had spent some time living under Hope Patton's tutelage in the vicarage at Walsingham, and he'd made his decision to become a Roman Catholic at the deserted Slipper Chapel during that time. This was not a neutral gesture. He now began an unconventional and what was bound to seem to Hope Patton a provocative ministry at the Slipper Chapel. Now, despite the huge numbers at the inauguration of the Catholic shrine in 1934, Roman Catholic pilgrimage to Walsingham was quite slow to build. Rank-and-file Catholic devotion to Mary was much more likely to express itself at Lourdes or Fatima than it was at a remote Norfolk village. But Scott James' charismatic personality soon made its mark, and from the middle of 1935, numbers began to build very steeply. He took to preaching in the open air on the steps of the Slipper Chapel up to eight times a day, and often with his elegant Siamese cat perched on his left shoulder. He also exercised a very powerful ministry to students and working men in the confessional. He spent hours hearing confessions. And by 1938, he estimated that there were 50,000 Roman Catholic pilgrims coming to the Slipper Chapel annually, though numbers that year were certainly boosted by a 10,000-strong national youth pilgrimage of reparation led by Cardinal Hinsley to mark the anniversary of the dissolution of the original shrine. Now, those kinds of numbers, they were episodic, but they were much larger than the Anglican shrine could muster from its much smaller, narrower Anglo-Catholic constituency. And they made expansion at the Slipper Chapel necessary. Scott James bought the field next door, built an open-air covered altar there, and added a new chapel of the Holy Spirit, a sacristy, a cloister, a row of lavatory blocks. Anglicans resented these signs of Roman Catholic temerity, and letters of protest flowed in, including a remonstrance from the Dean of Norwich, to which Scott James replied sweetly that he quite understood that when the Slipper Chapel had been in Anglican hands and used for animals and the storing of crops, no building work had been needed. But now that it had been restored to the glory of God, some development was necessary. So for both shrines, in the lead-up to the Second World War, there was a boom time. Both were enlarged to accommodate growing numbers, and it's at this time that the Anglican shrine took on its rather exotic, slightly Mediterranean appearance. But of course, the outbreak of the Second World War put an end to all of that. Walsingham was surrounded by Battle of Britain airfields. It was in a high security zone. It was closed to pilgrims. And that meant that both shrines had to start again in 1945. The story of Walsingham from the end of the Second World War is the story of a slow emergence of both shrines from rather different kinds of ghettos. Both shrines, like their medieval predecessor, had been founded to bear witness to the foundational truth of Christianity, that the Word was made flesh and dwelt amongst us, The Holy House and the Slipper Chapel were intended as images of that larger house of God in which the whole of humanity is invited to find its home. But being the work of human hands, they were both also something less inclusive, fortresses of exclusion, outposts on the hostile front line between the two churches, and in the case of the Anglican shrine, of division within a single church, a badge of party. The Anglican shrine, I think it's true to say, experienced a period of drift after the war. Father Hope Patton was aging, and many of his projects, like the creation of a college of canons at the shrine, following the Augustinian rule, he was trying to revive the medieval Augustinian priory, ended in failure. And although the number of parishes linked to the Anglican shrine continued to grow, one is always so moved by the lights in the Holy House with the parish names on them, which are such a testimony to that diaspora of the shrine. But at this stage, the shrine's appeal was still largely confined to a self-defining constituency of very advanced Anglo-Catholicism, easily caricatured as high camp, the world of gin, lace, the Beretta Brigade. And that's how it's admittedly affectionately caricatured by Andrew Wilson as the Walsingham Way in his Blackley comedy, comic novel, The Healing Art. But the very foundations of the Anglo-Papal movement which had given birth to the shrine were about to be shaken. Roman Catholic Mariology reached its high point in the decade after the Second World War, with the definition of the doctrine of the Assumption in 1950 and the Marian year of 1954, when the apostolic delegate came to Walsingham and crowned a new statue for the Slipper Chapel before a crowd of 20,000 pilgrims in the grounds of the priory. But even as it reached its apogee, there were signs of thaw in the apparently immovable iceberg of Roman Catholic teaching and practice. Changes manifested in the 1950s in the revival of the Easter Vigil and in papal encouragement of dialogue masses and of evening masses. And this trickle of change would turn into a tidal wave with the calling of the Second Vatican Council, with its far more drastic reforms. Hope Patton didn't live to see the Second Vatican Council, but his disapproval, even of Pius XII's more modest reforms, was signified by a notice he put up in the Shrine Church forbidding Anglican congregations to make the responses at Mass. The fact was that the revolution that was Vatican II cut the ground from under the whole Anglo-Papalist project, which had been to prepare the Church of England for reunion with Rome by bringing Anglican theology and practice into exact conformity with that of ultramontane Catholicism. There were parishes in which you wouldn't have noticed if overnight they had become Roman Catholic. Suddenly, the hitherto apparently changeless Catholic Church turned its back on the theological and liturgical flagpoles to which Anglo-Papalism had nailed its colours. I recall my own callow delight when, in the late 1960s, after the introduction of the stripped-down Missa Normativa of Paul VI, the Anglo-Papalist vicar of St. Clement's in Cambridge put a notice up in his porch: "The Bishop of Rome is no longer prayed for in this church." Had the Anglican shrine at Walsingham remained similarly entrenched in the old ways, it would surely have withered. But both shrines were about to experience transformation. Hope Patton died, characteristically dramatically, in 1958, immediately after officiating at benediction in the Shrine Church in the presence of eight bishops from the Lambeth Conference, all of them colonial. His successor, Father Colin Stevenson, a much more ebullient personality and a brilliant communicator, recognized the need to integrate the shrine more firmly within the Norwich Diocese. He began to act as a supply priest in the Norwich Diocese, to the amazement of some Norwich congregations. We're being looked after by Roman Catholics now, but they are very nice. And the wider Church of England. He brought a more open, less beleaguered ethos to the shrine. And that integration was, of course, assisted by a wider process, the assimilation of many aspects of Anglo-Catholic practice into the mainstream of Anglican worship, and by the growing number of appointments of Anglo-Catholic clergy to bishoprics. It was a slow process, but it reached a high point in 1985 when David Hope, Master of the College of Guardians and a former principal of Staggers and vicar of All Saints Margaret Street, became Archbishop of York in 1985. A much wider range of parishes, including many from a more rugged kind of Anglo-Catholicism in the north of England, was affiliating with the shrine. A larger and much more mixed constituency was turning up for the annual pilgrimage. And in 1980, Robert Runcie, Archbishop of Canterbury, preached at the annual pilgrimage, a precedent which has been followed by all his successors, even, dare I say it, George Carey. It has to be said, one of the most surreal moments of my life has been watching on television George Carey helping the Pope to open the Holy Door for the Jubilee and thereby releasing plenary indulgences for... The Roman Catholic shrine underwent equally profound change. One of the consequences of the council was a significant diminishment of the dominant place of Mary in Catholic piety, a move towards a more Eucharistic focus and a focus on the Bible. That may well turn out to have been a temporary swing of the pendulum. It affected Western European, American, and British Catholics much more than churches in the rest of the Catholic world, particularly Africa and Asia. And I think it's significant that ethnically based pilgrimages to the Slipper Chapel by Tamil and Filipino Catholics resident here in England form its largest constituency now. They come in numbers up to 20,000 at a time. But unquestionably, the most remarkable and momentous development was the transformation of Anglican Roman Catholic relationships in Walsingham. Down to the end of the 1950s, Roman Catholics had resolutely refused any communicatio in sacris with Anglicans or Protestants, hence the prohibition of Anglican prayer in the Catholic shrine. The more open ecclesiology and commitment to ecumenism of the Church after Vatican II meant that Catholics, in most cases with a huge sigh of relief, came down from the barricades and began to pray with and learn from their Christian brethren. This was facilitated by the move of the post-conciliar church to a different kind of Mariology, away from an exclusive emphasis on Mary's uniqueness and privileges, which in the pontificate of Pius XII had seemed likely to culminate in a theologically and ecumenically disastrous definition of Mary as mediatrix of all graces. Instead, the council proposed a Mariology of inclusiveness in which Mary was understood as type of the church and pattern of discipleship, concepts far more easily appropriated within the churches of the Reformation. And all this brought about a drastic transformation of the relations between the two shrines. I notice the time, we are moving towards a conclusion. In 1968, the newly founded Ecumenical Society of the Blessed Virgin Mary hosted a joint meeting of Anglicans and Roman Catholics associated with Walsingham. It included the two shrine administrators and the future Roman Catholic Bishop of East Anglia, Alan Clark. They pledged themselves to encourage joint pilgrimages, to regular shared worship in both shrines, to promote each other's shrines in their literature, to establish a permanent forum for cooperation, and they also undertook to share the priory site in the event that it ever came back into ecclesiastical ownership. Bishop Clark and the Anglican Suffragan Bishop of Lynn led the first ecumenical pilgrimage to Walsingham in 1970, and from then on, collaboration has built steadily, a process that culminated a year ago, of course, in the ecumenical covenant signed by the custodians of both shrines. One of the few encouraging signs of ecumenism in what is a rather bleak period for relations between our churches. There were notable landmarks along this road when, in 1982, Pope John Paul, not to be confused with Pope John Hall, celebrated Mass in Wembley Stadium. The custodians of the Anglican and Catholic shrines carried together the image of Our Lady of Walsingham to the Pope's altar. The year before, when the Anglican shrine celebrated its jubilee, the director of the Catholic shrine had preached. And in his sermon, he recognized Father Hope Patton as a prophet, an instrument of unity in God's hand and in the hand of Mary. Mary, who is the archetype of the listening disciple. She is here to heal these wounds of sin and division. She has used Father Patton and indeed many other faithful workers. She has taught us to listen, to understand, to tolerate, to grow in love. Our future seems to point towards ever closer unity. We must learn not only to pray together, which we do regularly, but to accept each other's differences and work together for a united future. We pray that we may be instruments in Mary's hands. Now, when those words were first spoken, the possibility of organic institutional unity between the Roman Catholic and Anglican churches seems closer to realization than I think it does today. The ordination of women and different approaches to issues of human sexuality, gender, marriage, family, issues which exist in both churches, but which are more overt and insistent within the Church of England at the moment, have created new and not easily resolvable barriers between our two communions. Within Anglicanism, the same issues have posed very difficult problems for Anglo-Catholics, one controversial outcome of which was the creation of the Ordinariate of Our Lady of Walsingham. And the growing openness of the culture at large to material and more sacramental forms of expression, including pilgrimage, which has boosted both shrines, does come at a price. As the shrine of flowers and candles and soft toys that sprang up after the death of Princess Diana demonstrate, material, incarnational manifestations of religiosity come much more naturally to the English than was the case when Father Patton began his work in the 1930s. But it's been accompanied and perhaps enabled by a corresponding haziness about the precise meaning of such forms of expression. Pilgrimage works for more people because it's far less closely integrated into Catholic and Anglican orthodoxies than was once the case. And it's been met by what Bishop North this morning very memorably spoke of as a lazy universalism on the part of the Church. Make of it what you will, but Monsignor Armitage tells me that the Slipper Chapel is now quite possibly the largest venue for Hindu pilgrimage in England. And gifts of gold deposited by Hindu pilgrims will be helping to pay for new mosaic work at the shrine. But when all that has been said, there remains the glorious fact that the racks of Walsingham have been rebuilt. The door into the household of Nazareth opened 9 centuries ago, give or take a few years, by Recheldis is open once more to welcome pilgrims from every nation, tribe, and tongue, and it would seem, creed. An unhealthy zeal to collect the scalps of other Christians has been transformed to a new and more generous and outward-turned new evangelization, in which both shrines, separately and importantly together, seek to witness to the human heart of God open for our salvation and to the nurturing care of his mother. Our Lady of Walsingham, pray for us.
Some 22 years ago, when I went up as an undergraduate to Cambridge, the most exhilarating, informative, and entertaining hours of my life were spent in Professor Duffy's supervisions. And we've had a real insight, Eamon, into not only your extraordinary sense of the breadth of history, but also your keen eye for the most entertaining and the most important micro-history. That is the skill of the supreme historian. I enjoyed what you said about Hope Patton. Many of us will remember Father Stevenson's book, Merrily on High, in which he tells the story of some extreme ordinands going to Walsingham and discovering on the sanctuary floor a feather. Finding an empty reliquary, they wrote the legend, St. Gabriel, Archangel, and placed it on the high altar. Eamon, your generosity of spirit, as well as your incisive nature, has given us an extraordinary afternoon, and we are tremendously in your debt.